You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the fall colors are starting to appear in parts of northern Wisconsin. We'll talk about where we can see great fall colors coming up and other great things to do in autumn in Wisconsin. Now, the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection is considering changes to the state's livestock siting rules. The rules set standards for things like where manure storage can go on a farm and how odor is managed. Many farmers are worried about the proposed changes, saying they'd hurt the industry, which is already feeling squeezed by low commodity prices and a trade war with China. John Holyvoat is Director of Government Affairs at the Dairy Business Association. He joins us now in the studio. John, thanks a lot for being with us today.
And thank you for having me.
We'll talk about what the current siting rules are and how they work.
Well, the rule was in, I suppose the statute was enacted in 2004, and the rules were written over a period of time and finally finalized in 2006. They provide us with a uniform way of regulating the siting of livestock operations, at least above a certain size, throughout the entire state. Local units of government are allowed to opt in to do this, but if they decide not to opt in, that means they really cannot regulate the siting of livestock facilities. So it's either participate in this program and use the rules developed by DATCAP or choose not to regulate those operations of that size.
So don't require a permit, or if you do, you use these rules, you can establish your own separate set of rules.
Unless you follow a procedure already established by the statute and the rules that allows for special circumstances where maybe some sort of local concern would give rise to a need for additional regulations.
Now, talk about what would change under these proposed rules.
Well, lots of different things would change, including some things that we as an organization find positive. There's some streamlining of the process, some things to make it work a little better for local governments and for the farmers to make sure everyone understands the process better and it functions better both on the front end where people are getting permitted as well on the compliance side after someone's been permitted. There are also significant changes to the way that we deal with odor management. Right now we have an odor scoring system that allows farmers to complete a worksheet to show what they're doing to mitigate odor and how far away they are from their nearest impacted neighbors. And if they're able to get a passing score on that sheet through the efforts that they're implementing on their farm, then they're allowed to construct their expansion that they planned. That is being done away with under the proposal at least, and would be replaced by pretty drastically increased setbacks meant to deal with odor, with the ability also for farmers to then buy back part of their setback through a more limited set of odor mitigation strategies.
And it seems like another change, if I have this right, these change standards would allow local governments to go beyond that the state rules, right? They would be able to impose maybe more stringent standards.
They'll still be pretty restricted in what they can do. The underlying framework for them to impose a stricter standard would be difficult. They always have the option to actually go the opposite direction too and actually do something that's sort of a half measure. They might say, yeah, we're going to implement livestock siting, but we're not going to go and use these setbacks. We're going to do something slightly less than. That's an option. But going more then is actually would still be limited.
Talking to John Holyvoat, Director of Government Affairs of the Dairy Business Association, about possible changes in state rules when it comes to the siting of either new livestock farms or expanding existing ones. So I think a lay person who's not in the industry, John, might be listening and thinking, okay, so what's the problem? Why is this of concern to your group and some other agriculture and processing groups around the state?
Yeah, it's a dense and complicated issue, and I don't pretend to say that it's not. I think a lot of people have testified at hearings across the state. There were 12 held by the department, and I would say that a lot of those folks that testified probably don't fully understand the rule themselves, and that's no fault of their own. Our main concerns surround two different issues. One, the setbacks that are replacing the odor scoring system, they're a huge increase from what we currently have. So
the setbacks is how far manure...
Manure storage, or in some cases, livestock siting...
From the
livestock housing,
or from the neighbors.
Would have to be, right. Mm-hmm. Like I said, right now, underneath the odor scoring, it's from your nearest impacted neighbor. This would shift to all based upon property lines and road or public right-of-ways, which can make a huge difference because maybe before you backed up to another farmer's field, and there that wasn't a concern because there was no house there or no people there to smell. So that is a big shift. And again, the numbers for the setback are quite large. In Wisconsin, we have a history of a lot of rural settlement. A lot of people live in the country who don't farm in the country. They just happen to live. Maybe they bought an acre off of a 40-acre plot, and they built a home there. That's great, and we're glad to have those people as our neighbors. But at the same time, that complicates things if we're going to go for radically increased setbacks based upon property line. It's going to make it difficult for some people to ever meet those standards. And one of our concerns is maybe we haven't properly tested those new setbacks to find out who would be impacted, how would people who have already been permitted fare under the new system, and are we expecting and asking too much of our farmers.
Now, supporters of the change say, hold on, these only kick in for a new facility or if an existing one wants to expand their operation, so that already permitted livestock operation wouldn't see a change. Is that right?
That is true. But you only have to grow by 20% to trigger falling underneath the new rules or having to seek a new permit. I was in private practice before I worked for Dairy Business Association. I liked it when my law firm grew 20%. It was my effort to try and see that to happen. Many farmers are in no different position. Business owners of all kinds would like to see or have the option of growing. Maybe you're going to have a new generation come home from maybe UW and join the farm. And you'd think you'd have to grow because of that. So there's lots of instances where that kind of growth would happen. So while that's true, it also we shouldn't just be cavalier about it because that's the case. There's a lot of instances where people are going to want to grow.
How big an impact do you see this potentially having on dairy farmers in the state if the changes went through as currently written, which seems kind of unlikely, but if they stayed as written, what would the impact be?
I think it would have a chilling effect on people who wanted to expand in the state and certainly on people who wanted to move and invest in the state. And those are two big, totally different issues, and people feel very differently about those, and I recognize that. Some people are fine with their a farm that's been down the road for 50 years growing, they might feel very differently about a new farm locating. But we try to stay competitive when it comes to our neighboring states. And the reality is many of our other states in the Midwest are actively courting our farmers and our dairy processors because they've seen the success that we have with our industry here. So it's not unusual to see whole delegations of people from South Dakota, for example, at World Dairy Expo that's coming up in October. And they'll be there trying to court people and bring them to South Dakota. So we have to be cognizant about, you know, where our position is in the industry overall right now and whether or not we want to maintain that. We generate a lot of money for the state. We keep rural communities vibrant. And, you know, we're on the license plate, right? We're part of our heritage and part of our identity as Wisconsinites.
What is the process now? This is, as you said, we've been through hearings now. Who is ultimately the decider on these changes?
Well, the ultimate decider probably is the legislature. But there's multiple steps involved to get us to that point. Actually, tomorrow morning, the Department of Ag is going to have their board meeting. They're going to have an update at least on the scope of the testimony that was received, the written comments that were received. And then they're going to come back in November and vote on whether to move the rules forward or not. Well, as you mentioned earlier, I anticipate probably a modified version of the draft that we saw already. They either will say move that ahead or move it or not. It'll then go to the governor. He'll have the chance to approve it or not. And from there, if he approves it, it'll go on to the legislature where they can do a whole host of things. They could reject it outright. They could send it back for modifications on certain areas of concern, or they could accept it through passive review or through active review.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's John Holivoat, Director of Government Affairs at the Dairy Business Association, with us today to talk about changes being proposed to the state's livestock siting rules that some farmers say could put some of them out of business or at least hurt their industry. We're also working on bringing you another perspective from one of the environmental groups that supports the rule changes. Listen for more on that later this week. Coming up, a Wisconsin photographer is being honored by the NFL for a particular photo he took of Brett Favre in the snow. We'll talk about why and get some tips on how to take better pictures ourselves. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, one of the most iconic photos of Packers quarterback Brett Favre was recently named one of the top 100 shots in NFL history. We'll meet the photographer who snapped it. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a Why Wisconsin question about a rare butterfly.
We recently received a listener question from Rachel Potter in Fitchburg. She wondered, Why don't more Wisconsinites know about the Regal Fritillary Butterfly? Good question, Rachel. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy recently put on her hiking shoes and set out to find one on a restored prairie in southwestern Wisconsin. Rich Henderson of the Prairie Enthusiasts took her exploring.
It's not too wet. Maybe if we walk, we'll flush them.
Wait, that's flying like a regal. It's behaving like a regal. Oh, come on, settle so I can get a look. Settle. It looks like a regal. The back end's flashing black, white, black light. Top side of the back end is lots of dark. In the front end, there's lots of orange. It looks like you took two different species of butterfly.
It's a beautiful summer day. About 80 degrees, sunny, no wind. Perfect conditions for butterfly watching.
Are you seeing a white flash on the bottom side?
I think so.
The regals can be pretty active, but they tend to stay kind of low like he was doing, dropping mm-hmm. down, coming up.
Kind of like that one right there? See it come up and down?
Oh, boy. No.
Yeah. It's moving this way.
That's a regal. That is definitely a regal.
The Regal Fritillary. It's majestic, it's charismatic, and it's one of Wisconsin's severely threatened prairie butterflies. But back to the listener's question, why aren't more Wisconsinites familiar with the elusive butterfly? Or why do monarchs get all the attention?
So when something's that well-known and popular and it starts to decline, it resonates with people. Regal fritillaries have been so rare for so long, a lot of people don't know they exist. But at one time, 100 years ago, regal fritillaries were as common as monarchs.
Henderson said to think back to your elementary school science class. What insect was used to illustrate metamorphosis? The monarch. That isn't to say the monarch isn't deserving of the attention and support. But the reality is, the regal is far more endangered than the monarch. And bigger picture, it's not one species that needs to be saved. It's an entire ecosystem. The insects are rare because the prairie ecosystem is rare.
We've converted or have lost 99% of the habitat.
That was Jay Watson, a conservation biologist at the DNR.
So the really little postage stamp size things all over the landscape. And these butterflies used to, you know, move all over the landscape. It was intact. But now it's kind of like the island effect where they wink out here and there's no way to recolonize. So then they're gone from that side. Then they're gone from another site. And all those little events add up into, and all of a sudden, the species is kind of going down the extinction vortex.
Watson says that while there are a few butterfly communities still hanging on around Wisconsin, regals have all but disappeared east of the Mississippi. Oklahoma, Kansas, and Nebraska are the only strongholds left. Watson said helping regals is a little trickier than, say, planting milkweed for monarchs. Regals are picky about their habitat. They need lots of open space and lots of islets. Watson says it's been a good couple of years for regals and other butterflies, but it only takes one extreme season to knock them out at a site, and it's a constant challenge to restore and maintain enough habitat.
They were persisting in areas that were grazed. People had their cows on there, and if they weren't grazed too intensely, there was still enough violets and enough of that intact system left.
Watson says different types of management could benefit the regals. He says the first step is being aware of the different requirements species need to live out their life cycle. And for regals, that means more intact prairies.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us this report on the regal fritillary butterfly. And this story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every single Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, they say a picture is worth a thousand words, but how about if that picture is one of the all-time best in National Football League history? Back in January 2008, Wisconsin State Journal photographer Steve Apps covered a Green Bay Packers divisional playoff game against the Seattle Seahawks at Lambeau Field. He took what became one of the most famous shots of Packers quarterback Brett Favre. Came at the end of the third quarter as the Packers were threatening to find the end zone. Favre appears to be all alone on the field, getting covered with snow and pointing toward the south end zone. And there's some drama to go along with the image. The Packers had started off 14-0. They wound up beating Seattle 42-20, going to their first NFC Championship game in a decade. Also, I believe Favre's final win at Lambeau as a member of the Packers. Last week, in honor of the NFL's 100th season, Apps Shot was named one of the top 100 photos in league history. Steve Apps joins us in the studio. Steve, thanks for coming up.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, I set the scene there somewhat with this photo. Now take us to where you're standing on the field and what you're seeing there.
Yeah, that game, what's most interesting about that game is that having covered, you know, myself and other Wisconsin photographers covered so many Packer games, it was just so different being because it's, all of a sudden the snow started falling midway through the second quarter and it was just looking so different. And it's at one point it was snowing so hard you couldn't even we had to stop taking pictures because you couldn't see through your lenses anymore. And what made this picture interesting was that, you know, I guess the picture shows is Favre all by himself in a snowstorm. And just, you know, a lot of people ask exactly, you know, what was the situation? Why is he all by himself? Why is
it looks like it's posed. Like, yeah, why does everybody get off the field for Favre?
Yeah, why is he pointing the other direction? And it comes down to something as simple as it was towards the end of the third quarter. And what it was 21 seconds left. I have this written down because like, it's sometimes hard to remember it. But Favre handed off to Brandon Jackson, if anybody can remember who that is.
Oh, yeah.
Who ran around the right end for a 10-yard gain to the Seattle 5-yard line, which is why as the clock was running out, Favre was not going to walk up to the line of scrimmage. So that's why he was all by himself. And I had noticed, normally I play like that. I photograph with a 400-millimeter lens, and I have a second camera around my neck with a 70-200. And he started, you know, Favre had started turning around to walk back to the other end zone. And I noticed that he was kind of excited. He was really giddy. And so I don't know why I did this because I usually don't, but I switched to my 70-200 millimeter lens, and which gave it a more wide look to it, and just started, you know, hit the motor drive. And he just did one of these, you know, all of a sudden he kind of jumped up a little bit and pointed for the first down and then continued to walk. And it was just so different because if I was using the other lens, the compression would have made the snow so much thicker that maybe you wouldn't have even seen him in the snowstorm. So by switching to a, you know, different lens made the picture better.
Now you take, I imagine, during the course of the game, what, hundreds, thousands of
thousands,
pictures?
Thousands of photos.
Okay, you're taking this one. Did you think then, as you're taking this picture, that this is going to be a good one?
You know, going back when we're editing these things, this is, you know, it's a late afternoon game. I have to edit on deadline. And so I edit quick. I mean, I just go back and do, you know, picture, 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 picture. I only look at the pictures for, you know, half a second. And I did not send this one that night, you know, as a selection for the next day's newspaper. And I went back and I always go back and look at my pictures the day after because I always miss something because I edit too quickly. And then I looked at that and I go, wow, this is really different. And then it really started to grow on me.
Now, here we are years later and the NFL says, yeah, not just a good picture, one of the best 100 pictures in NFL history. What's that like to hear that?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. But this picture also at the time, it was awarded the picture of the year back in 2008. Mm-hmm. It was called the Dave Boss Award of Excellence, which was kind of fun because it was when you were selected as a picture of the year, they give you a trip to Canton, Ohio during the induction ceremony. So for 3 days, I had VIP treatment in Canton, Ohio, the same weekend as the people being inducted. So I always joke about that my picture got to the Hall of Fame before Brett Favre did. And it was kind of fun because it's a huge event and people take that very seriously. And it was fun.
What makes for a great sports photo? It isn't just the visual. It seems like the good ones, and looking at these 100, including yours, there's a story in them.
Yeah, sports photography is broken down into pretty much two selections or two categories. There's action and feature. And this would be considered a feature picture, being that the action's pretty obvious. It's some, you know, some
you're throwing
moment.
The ball, you're catching the ball.
Yeah, it's just some, you know, somebody flying through the air, and there's and those are pretty hard to get, but features are different. That's open to interpretation, being that there's just, you know, something that looks different. And this picture was something that looked very different than, you know, most photographs.
And there's 100 here, and I noticed flipping through, the Packers are heavily represented. And you were telling me before we came on the air, there's some other great Wisconsin photographers you might want to give a shout out
to.
Yeah,
there's, you know, the Beaver family, Vernon Beaver, was the original pack photographer. He was represented. His sons, John Beaver, who went on to a great career with Sports Illustrated, is represented. Jim Beaver, who was a longtime Packer photographer, is represented. Andy Manis, freelancer from Madison, who works for AP, is represented. Mike Romer and Maury Gash are also represented in this series of pictures.
Is there something about the setting, Lambeau Field, that just makes it, I don't know, makes for a better picture, makes it more fun to take pictures there?
You know, it's, I've, when I worked for the, when I still work for the State Journal, but when I cover the Packers, you know, home and on the road, for 12 years, I covered every Packer game. So I covered 200 in a row. I've been to every stadium in the NFL. Lambeau Field is by far the best stadium to work in. The best stadium has the best fans, and visually it's the most appealing. And so it's just, it's a great place. The light is beautiful certain times of year.
Do you have advice for people trying to take their own sports photos? I'll never be good at it, but for those who there's hope for, what would you tell them? A quick nutshell lesson.
Yeah, it's the best thing to do with sports. It's, if you look at all those pictures, you got to keep them clean. Watch your background is what makes a photograph like the Favre picture. If you look around the background, there's nothing distracting, taking away from the subject matter. If you look at all the other photographs and that they're represented, they're clean pictures. You could stand back from your computer and look at those photographs from 4 feet away, and you could still understand the photographs because they're clean, and they just pop out at you.
Do you ever go through your archives and say, "Oh, I was too quick to edit that one out," and find a hidden gem that you wish you'd sent to the paper that Sunday?
You know, I just started. You know, back in the first Super Bowl I covered for the State Journal was back in 1998 when the Packers were in San Diego. And I had all those negatives, and I did a very quick edit that night. And then their negatives, I just never looked at them again. I just recently scanned them all.
Wow.
And so I'm going back and looking at something like 700 photographs, which is a lot for film, but not a lot, you know, nowadays.
Digital, yeah.
But I was looking at some of these photographs for the first time, and it's like, wow, I couldn't believe it, you know, I have these pictures. And I'm just starting to edit them. So
there might be a book there. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Steve Apps, photographer with Wisconsin State Journal, taker of one of the top 100 pictures in NFL history, according to Liga, snow globe picture of Brett Favre on the field. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, U.S. Representative Gwen Moore joins the program for a look at some of the top issues facing Congress and how they could affect Wisconsin. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, according to TravelWisconsin.com's fall color report, the leaves are just starting to turn in a handful of northern counties in the state. We've got at least a couple of weeks before they reach their peak there. Colors in southern Wisconsin, generally a week or so behind the north. So have you made your plans to check them out? And even if you're not into leaf peeping, there are a lot of other fun and tasty events and activities around the state in the weeks ahead. Gary Knowles is a Madison-based travel writer and president of the Midwest Travel Journalists Association. He's the author of the great Wisconsin touring book, 30 Spectacular Auto Tours. Gary, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Hey, what a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, you could talk for about 2 hours on this question, but what are your, some of your favorite places, Gary, to see the fall colors in the state?
I've got a bunch of them, but one that I just added recently, we took our convertible group up to Eau Claire, and I love Eau Claire, and it's a great city. If you go up there, you don't want to miss the Artisan Forge place, which is a nest of artists. It's really neat, and you don't want to miss that. Carson Park is always beautiful, but in fall, it's really nice. So that's right in the city of Eau Claire, and you'll want to see that. But, you know, there's a part of Wisconsin that most people never go to. And have you ever been to Prague, Wisconsin?
I have not.
Cream?
Nope.
And most people haven't.
You're stumping me, yeah.
It's like one of those places that unless you intentionally find the map, and it's not even on a lot of maps, but if you find the map and you go there, you're going to say, holy cow, how did I miss this? It's down south and west of Eau Claire, and it's east of the Great River Road area. There's kind of that coulee country down there where there's a lot of beautiful rolling hills and great little rivers that run through them, and no reason to go there. And I hate to say that, but the reason to go there is because it is so beautiful. if you get to a place down there called Prague, it's on Highway 88. If you take Highway 37 south of Eau Claire and then go down through Mondovi and then veer off on the Highway 88, again, unless you're going somewhere down there, you probably never would. It's an incredibly beautiful road that was designed by some feng shui artist, I think. And it's just twisting. It goes up through the hills, and it goes down to a little community that, if you blink, you'll miss it, called Prague. And in Prague, you don't want to eat before you go, because if you got to get down there, you want to stop at a great little bar called Buck Knuckles. And it's one of those backcountry bars. I would put it in the league with Tom's Burndown Cafe up on Madeline Island. And there's a couple others that are really one-off kind of unique bars. And it's a bar, but they do their own barbecue roasting down there. They've got a fire truck, and they roast barbecue on the back of the fire truck. and it is just an amazing place. We took our people there, and they loved it. And if you continue down from Buck Knuckles, you have your lunch, and you continue down from there on Highway 88, you'll get down to Highway E. Take Highway E, it winds up and all over and through the hills and eventually gets over to Danziger Vineyards, which is a new winery that I discovered down there. And, you know, and because I discovered it doesn't mean that other people didn't before me. It's a beautiful place. And it's just up, it's actually up from Alma up in the hills, overlooks the Mississippi River, the Great River Road. It's probably about 500 feet up in the air, and one of the most beautiful views of the river you're going to see.
Wow. Now, I know you've been coming on Ideas Network shows for years now, Gary, and I know you're a fan of doing the kind of thing you just said, finding the place that's off the beaten path, that gives you a lot of joy. Give a pep talk to people to try to replicate that and to try to find these things that maybe aren't front and center in their minds.
Well, it's, you know, in Wisconsin, you're lucky because you're really always just a couple of good turns off of the big road onto a smaller road to a smaller road where these places are hidden. Well, they're not hidden, but people just don't see them unless you actually do that. A good example, and this is one that a lot of people will find and have found, if you go to Door County, and most people get to Door County, they cross the bridge at Sturgeon Bay, they think, I'm in Door County now, and they travel around, and they go to Sister Bay, beautiful place, they get over to Ephraim, and maybe go over to Bailey's Harbor. A lot of people just don't make it all the way up to the tip. If you make it up to the tip, you're going to be rewarded with a drive on what I call the Jen Jensen's Highway, which is this most beautiful little section of highway in Wisconsin, I think, designed by a landscape architect named Jen Jensen, who also was the guy who built the clearing there, which is a great architectural place. But if you go to Jen Jensen's Highway, it's the one that you've seen, because I know you've seen a picture of it, and it looks like a snake going down about a mile and a half, 2 miles, and it goes all the way down to where you catch the ferry over to Washington Island. But that's the kind of place you get rewarded by if, you know, you take the drive and go a little extra farther and maybe take a different turn. So I would suggest that one for sure.
Talking to Gary Knowles, travel writer here in Wisconsin, author of the Great Wisconsin Touring book. We are getting some inspiration on awesome ways to enjoy Wisconsin in the autumn, whether it involves looking at leaves, events, restaurants, you name it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for Gary or a favorite place to share with us. Gary, you're a big fan of local events. It's not just a special place, but a special time at that place. What are some of the upcoming events that you're looking out for?
Well, hey, I've got to tell you, on Friday, how about, you know, you probably can't make it to Angkor Wat or the Great Wall of China. Maybe you could if you left right now. But on Friday, we have our very own UNESCO World Heritage Site here in the Madison area, and they're doing an event called the Garden Tour. It's Taliesin, and you probably have done a program on this already, knowing that Taliesin was one of eight Frank Lloyd Wright sites around the U.S., just named to the UNESCO list of World Heritage Sites. They're having a garden tour out there on Friday, well worth doing. And if you can't make that, on the 29th, they're doing a Taste of Taliesin out there. Certainly recommend that. It's coming right up. You're probably not going to see a lot of fall color right now, But, you know, Taliesin being one of those places, definitely worth a visit. And I'd say get on out there and see it. They do a great tour of the house now. And they have docents out there that'll tell you great stories about Frank Lloyd Wright.
We asked on Facebook for people to recommend places and events. Sherry writes the Apple Fest in Gays Mills, September 27 to 29. Sherry says visit all the orchards, go to the flea market, and don't miss the parade. Gays Mills known for apples, Gary.
Yeah, for sure. And as a matter of fact, it was on my list too.
It is.
And I want to second it. Yeah. Speaking of great drives, there's a great drive along the ridge out there. It goes by some of the orchards, but it's just a beautiful drive over in the Gays Mills area. So definitely check that out. And speaking of apples, coming up October 4th to the 6th is kind of the granddaddy apple festival of them all. The Bayfield Apple Festival up in Bayfield, another area that I head for automatically when I get out on the road, and if I could, I would be up there a lot. But it's going to be taking place the 4th to the 6th, and if you do it, they have apple brats. You can try the apple brats up there, as well as a lot of other things made with apples, apple pancakes, and apples themselves by the bushel. But don't miss the opportunity to jump on the ferry and catch it over to Madeline Island. And Madeline Island is just a place out of time all by itself, and it's so historical. And the neat thing is it's a bilingual island, and you may know this, but the English is a first language up there, I think, but Ojibwe is the second language, and they have all the signs that have now been put in the Ojibwe language. So you'll see it says welcome to La Pointe, and then it says in a language I can't speak, in Ojibwe, welcome to La Pointe. But it's great. It's a bilingual little island, and don't miss Tom's Burndown Cafe, another one of those good little bars.
And we also heard from Alexandra on Facebook, I think one that is also on your list, Gary, the Fall Art Tour in southwestern Wisconsin. Alexandra says it's a must if you like arts and crafts.
It is, and you're going to need to plan. You know, you need to plan more than one day to do it, because it stretches out kind of from Baraboo all the way down through Spring Green, through Dodgeville, down to Mineral Point, and even sort of toward the south of there. But there are so many places to see and so many really good artists on the list. I tried doing it in a day one time, and I did a lot of good driving, but I didn't have enough time to go to all the places I wanted.
We're talking about the best ways to take in Wisconsin's fall colors, enjoy the sights, sounds, tastes, and events of the season. Travel writer Gary Knowles is with us. His finger is on the pulse. He's the author of the great Wisconsin touring book, 30 Spectacular Auto Tours. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite thing to do, your favorite place to go in Wisconsin in the autumn? Do you have a favorite place to go to look at leaves? Do you make plans to take them in? What are your other favorite ways to celebrate the season? Any festivals or events you think people should check out? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about some of the fun things to see and do in Wisconsin this fall. Gary Knowles is with us, Madison-based travel writer, president of the Midwest Travel Journalists Association. He's the author of the great Wisconsin touring book, 30 Spectacular Auto Tours. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Gary about a place to go in your area or where you're traveling? He will have an answer. If you want to put in a plug for your favorite place to go in the fall, maybe a local event you want to put the word out on, call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Suzanne joins us now in Beaver Dam. Suzanne, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Suzanne?
Well, one place that my sister recently took me to in the summer, up north by Clam Lake, Wisconsin. That's where they're introducing the elk population. And in the summer, it was just gorgeous. And me and my sister are looking really forward to going up there in a couple weeks when the fall colors show up.
Did you see any elk?
Well, the last time I didn't, I told my sister I was going to sue her, but but she promises me next time we go. We drove all over, too. There's some beautiful rustic roads up there, too, official rustic roads. And I've taken about, I think, about 101 of them so far.
Wow.
So they have pretty ones. Yeah, needless to say, my Subaru suffered for it, but it's worth it.
Suzanne, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Have you checked out the elk yourself, Gary?
I have not seen an elk. I've been looking for them whenever I get up in that area, and I understand they're doing very well, but I have not seen any myself.
Do you have any other favorite places, Gary, where we might see some wildlife, whether it's elk or maybe a smaller species?
Well, you know, deer are everywhere. I've got to say that, and, you know, we were talking about spring green before, and down in southwest Wisconsin, if you do that fall art tour, don't be surprised if you see some deer down there. The fields off of Highway even 23, which is a pretty major road down there, are often loaded with deer, especially watch out at dusk because they're all over the place down there. And that first area I was telling you about, too, when I was driving through there, kind of discovering Prague and Cream, I think I dodged four deer in 2 days going through the back roads back there. Deer have really multiplied in Wisconsin, so you see a lot of them. Turkeys are everywhere. The other day, I actually, on the west side of Madison, saw two turkeys chasing a bus, believe it or not, off of Whitney Way. But yeah, so you'll see a lot of wildlife in the state. Eagles over on the Great River Road, if you get over near Wabasha, which, of course, is across the river in Minnesota. But go over to the La Crosse area, head up toward Alma and Stockholm. Plenty of eagles in that area.
Thanks again for that call, Suzanne, at 800-642-1234. As we talk about great things to do in the autumn with Gary Knowles, travel journalist. Gary, I know you also love museums that maybe aren't, you know, at the top of people's minds. And you've got one in Milwaukee for us.
Yeah, the Grauman Museum in Milwaukee, which all the years I've lived in Wisconsin, I never was at it. It's at the Milwaukee School of Engineering, the Grauman Museum. It just mounted a great new show, and it's called The Magnificent Machines of Milwaukee. And you probably know, but a lot of people don't, that Wisconsin has all these inventors. Harley Davidson, I guess people know that the Harley Davidson comes from here. But you know, the QWERTY typewriter board came out of Milwaukee.
That had a Milwaukee connection. I heard that a couple years ago.
That's right. Yeah. That was a Milwaukee connection. Some deep sea diving equipment was developed in Milwaukee.
That I didn't know.
Huge mining equipment was developed over in that area by some of the industrialists. But they have a show that features a lot of these things, some in pictures, some actual equipment over there. Of course, the outboard motor, Ole Evinrude developed that. He wanted to take his wife to get ice cream, I guess. And the fastest way to get the ice cream across the lake was to have an outboard motor, so he built one. But there's really neat exhibits over there, and they have a really great sculpture garden, and it's like up on the top of the building in Milwaukee at Milwaukee School of Engineering, and you can see some incredible vistas of Milwaukee when you get up there. So certainly that's one place. And then if you're into wildlife, you might want to head up to Wausau to see the Birds and Art exhibit, which is up there. It opened, I think, September 6th or so, but it runs until December 1st, and it is an amazing exhibit. And, you know, you see birds and art, and you're thinking, you know, a picture of an owl, a picture of a crow, how many can you do? Well, they have some of the most unusual and greatest art about birds you're ever going to see in Wausau at the Lee Yawkey Woodson Museum. And the good news is it's open till December 1st, and it's free. So go check that one out.
Sounds fantastic. Larry from Madison called, couldn't stay on the line. He says Highway 53 in Menominee is a beautiful drive for fall colors.
It is. It certainly is. It goes all the way up toward Superior and, you know, great colors up in that area.
All right. And we've got Carl now on the line in Elkhorn. Carl, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Carl?
When I was in high school back in the 70s, I met some people from Gillett, Wisconsin, and they turned me on to a place called Butler Rock near Mountain. We would climb to the top of Butler Rock. It's not a very terrible climb. And if you face west, you're above the trees. And in the fall, with all the colors, it's spectacular.
I'm going to have to check that one out. I have not been to Butler Rock, but it sounds great.
Well, it's on your list now, Gary.
It's
Carl, thank you so much for sharing that. I've never been there in the autumn. I've been there in the summer to Tim's Hill. In northern Wisconsin.
Highest spot in Wisconsin.
Right, high, and then there's a tower making it even higher. And I've seen pictures of looking down at the fall colors from there. That seems like that'd be a real treat.
There are some great shots from there, and my guess is that Steve Apps probably has one of them.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Greg with us on Facebook. He mentioned the 2019 Trek CX Cup. Apparently, it's taking place tomorrow through Sunday at Trek's headquarters in Waterloo. So this is a bike race, but they've got a whole festival built around it. I don't know if you've been to that one, but we've got a lot of sports and recreation events and tourism in the state.
That's for sure. The bike racing is really kind of neat, and I know they've done a lot of it kind of over in southwest Wisconsin. They like those hills over there, and boy, in autumn, it's a great time to go out and see it. And thanks to Trek, we've got some really incredible bicycles to race on here in the state, too.
Now, we've gotten comments from listeners on Facebook and elsewhere liking a lot of places in the Shawamigan-Nicolet Forest. Now, there's a lot of forest there. How do we narrow it down if we want to check out the sites there, Gary?
The good thing is you really don't have to narrow it
down. Okay,
good. You can kind of go to almost any of it. My suggestion is if you really want to go see a stretch that a lot of people don't get to, go up to, again, we're going up to the Bayfield area, the Bayfield Peninsula. And if you go to Cornucopia, which is the northernmost little community up there on the tip of the peninsula, and head down on the fire roads, the National Forest Service has these fire roads that go down. There's one up there that I think it is number 336. But if you go up to Cornucopia, ask them for the road that goes down the Highway 2, and it is spectacular. There's nothing on it. You know, you go down Highway C and you catch it, and you go all the way down to Highway 2. But there is just beautiful sand barrens in that area, great colors, great things to see, and probably a lot of that wildlife you're looking for.
Now, you know what I like is waterfalls. And I got to admit, I've done a lot of waterfall tourism in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I've done very little here in Wisconsin. I don't know why. I really like waterfalls. Where should I go, Gary?
Go to Copper Falls. It's easy to get to. It's on that same drive up there. If you want to go, the elk aren't far away. and the Copper Falls is right up there. It's a great state park. The one thing, of course, that happens in autumn is that the rivers are not as high and raging as they are in springtime, but there's still some great falls to see. I would definitely check that out. And if you get over into the Hurley area, you might want to take a little bit of a hike and go over and see Potato River Falls, a poorly named falls because it's a beautiful waterfalls. And I guess it's because it's a potato river. But if they'd have named it Wolf Falls, you couldn't keep people away from it.
What is next, Gary, on your travel plans? I know you've always got something in the works.
I'm looking for actually maybe in October, early October. I want to get up to Willersheim for Willersheim Winery over at Prairie du Sac. They have their release of their ice wine, and that's always a good time to sample what they call the nectar of the vines. It's probably the sweetest wine they make, and it's a great dessert wine, but always look forward to trying that out. So I'll probably be doing a little short drive up there.
Yeah, people are doing a lot of brewery tourism, but now winery and distillery tourism in Wisconsin.
That's true, and speaking of distilleries, they just added one up there about a year ago over at Willersheim, their distillery is cranking out lots of incredible good spirits. And also, if you get up in that area, over in the area near Dane, Wisconsin, the J. Henry people are making some incredible bourbon, and might want to check that out.
Well, you've left us all in good spirits. Gary, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
It's Gary Knowles, Madison-based travel writer, president of the Midwest Travel Journalists Association. We talked to them about great ways to enjoy fall around Wisconsin. You can keep sharing your suggestions, by the way, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at a National Park Service report that shows potential damage to many archaeological sites if the construction of a southern border wall goes ahead. We'll also hear about the latest efforts to turn the tide on obesity here in Wisconsin and what the numbers show about obesity rates here in the state. Plus, a Wisconsin congressional representative joins the show for a look at the debate over a plan to base new fighter jets here in Wisconsin. All that, plus a look at some of the top news stories of the day. And as always, you can join in the conversation on the phone or online. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6:30, Wisconsin's workforce is getting older. And Kate's guest says the state needs to bring more people in from around the country and maybe beyond to maintain a vital economy. It's tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then our guest explains why she says America's fertility industry is in serious need of federal regulation. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.